Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, growing food in cities. Swiss filmmaker Marie-Luce Storm's film is being shown at Windmill Hill. It's called Gardens of Hope. And Trevor Mealham, he speaks to us from the Lloyds Bank Victims Group about the branch at Wine Street on Castle Park, and allegations continue there that Avon and Somerset police are not investigating what could be up to £1 billion in fraud. Could this be Bristol's crime of the century? And also, Bristol against organ harvesting. We speak to Alex Joseph, who's worried that Guangzhou in China, which Bristol is twinned with, there's organ harvesting going on there by the Chinese government. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectsradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street.
I'm a French citizen living in Switzerland. My name is Marie-Luce Storm, and I was trained as a geographer, a human geographer, but I turned into filmmaking because this is a way to address really very interesting and very sensitive points.
So what is human geography?
Human geography is basically how people and societies design their territories. So there is a layer of social infrastructures and also urban geography, of course, geopolitics. So we address all these points and see how they connect to design the territories we live in.
But I think when you're talking about design, I think people, certainly in this country, in the cities, feel that they don't have any say in the design, not even of their own homes, other than which picture they're going to hang on the wall, maybe, and what colour the bedroom's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, you're a step ahead now, because this will be the main topic of the next film I'm going to do.
Okay, but so how do different countries compare as to what amount of control individual citizens have over the space, the immediate space, their own home, and the space around them?
Well, this was over history, actually, because, you know, the houses we are living in at the moment were built mainly in the past century and in the century before, in the 19th century. And this was the time for a very bourgeois society. So the levels of the, and the height of the floors and also the space, how it is connected, was all designed by the bourgeoisie at that time. And we still live in that kind of places, even if architects are designing flats a bit differently now. And also, even if there is a bit of reappropriation of the public space or in between blocks by the people, and they try to do something else, just not green loans, and because we know that it's not sustainable anymore. So people are trying to reappropriate this space, make community gardens, for example, or I mean
the spaces around us are changing a lot. I mean, there seems to be, for example, pubs, hundreds of pubs a week seem to be closing down. I'm not sure what the exact rate is. So this is public space, a public house, somewhere to go for a drink. But you also see a lot of derelict property, particularly industrial property. So how does Bristol compare to other cities around Europe, do you think?
Well, I'm slowly discovering about Bristol, but what I know is, for example, in Geneva, there was a trend for the last 30 years that people in derelict buildings, for example, were trying to appropriate that space to live in. So they had what they call the trust contract with the municipality. And this trust contract says that it's not exactly a squat. And the new residents they promise to improve the building and to maintain it. And so it's free of rent. And this was for 10 years or 20 years. And then slowly the residents were creating cooperatives, housing cooperatives, so they can buy the buildings. And they can also, they were able to do whatever they want with the buildings. So they were improving the flats and also managing the communal spaces. And actually the housing cooperatives in Geneva are very powerful. And they are so powerful at the moment that they can create their own neighborhoods.
How?
Well, they have the power to negotiate with the municipality and the canton to not to own the ground, of course, but to build new buildings and the way they want. So, for example, what they do is they design buildings with communal spaces where people can cook together. But this is created from the start because they have this idea that a building is not just a sum of flats where people just go back to sleep and things like that. This is really places to live.
It's almost like maybe an enormous house with, you know, hundreds of people living in it that needs extra facilities, like, you know, maybe nice wine cellar, a library, you know, so there's all sorts of other places that can be built in. But anyway, you're here in Bristol at the moment to show your film up at Windmill Hill called The Gardens of Hope that you made 2 years ago. What's that film about?
Well, this was also my first film about community bonds, actually. But this is another way to address it. So I went, the first one I saw was in San Francisco, and then I was traveling around, and then I met a group of residents and associations which were really trying to just have a patch of land and create something for the people of the buildings around. And slowly the people were coming to see what was happening and what they were trying to grow or things. And places like Paris, for example, I mean, I visited a garden, it's in the 19th arrondissement, and it took really 3 years, but little by little, because there was a square next to, and the people were starting to come and to ask for a patch of land in this small garden, and started to grow tomatoes, and also they had this system to share the tools and to water the plants when people were away. So they started to create bonds between them. And I went to Lisbon, I went to Geneva, where the system is a bit different because it's more private owners that share their gardens. And I went to Lincoln in the north of England, and where the people in a small residence, they gather to improve their courtyard or their backyard, and the city council helped them at first. So they don't give a lot of money, but they have facilities, they have trucks and things like that to really start. And I met the association Green Synergy, and Green Synergy has people to design the future garden, and they help a lot. And what they're trying to do is to have gardens that last. So, because we know that it takes time to recreate bonds between people.
So it's about making sure that the management of the garden takes place into the future, and that maybe some property developer doesn't get their hands on it and do something, maybe building something to make some money out of that. I mean, is that how successful have they people been at building community bonds to make sure that it does last?
I think that, yeah, that was the main point. That was really to recreate bonds. So after that, Green Synergy can step back and let the people grow whatever they want, but all together, and make sure that it doesn't last a year or two, but longer than that.
I mean, if anybody is listening and can think of a little piece of land near them, it may be owned by the city council, and they've got some ideas they want to do with it. Is there anything you can say to help them to turn that into a reality rather than, I mean, I think we all do this. You go past a piece of land maybe every day on the way to work or, you know, on to school or something, and you think, well, this is it's a criminal shame that that piece of land is being neglected.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I learned from the people I interviewed in the film was gardening is not for everyone. So we can do whatever we want. I mean, it's only the people who are interested in who's going to turn up and stay. The other thing I learned from this from the film is that it takes time. So it's good to be a community. It's good to be at least a group of 5 to 10 people to make sure that if there is a kind of demotivation at one point, because sometimes the negotiations with the council, they take time. So we're gonna really motivate each other a lot.
Okay, is there any sort of success stories in your film?
I think Lisbon is a very, very interesting success story. Because at first, that was the people who were just gathering in the parks, really, in the parks of the city. And they were starting to grow vegetables, to grow food. And then after maybe 2 years, well, the municipality started to realize what was happening. And instead of, you know, stepping back or forbidden what was happening, the municipality started to realize that they could help. So this is the first step. I mean, and the municipality, the person I interviewed there was really clear about that. I mean, it's important for politicians to really look at what happens and to help what is good for people. So the municipality started to buy or to build some sheds for the tools and to enlarge also the patch of lands which were available. And they also bought some tools and seeds as well. And they really managed to open a lot more patch of land for the people who are willing to grow. And when I visited Lisbon, I mean, we had a whole day touring around the city to see how many of new gardens there were.
But I wonder in Lisbon, I mean, do the people, like they do here in Bristol, have a whole tradition of allotments where there's always places to grow food if they want in Lisbon?
There's still a lot of land in Lisbon, yeah.
But I mean, do they have allotments in Lisbon before that? Because I mean, Britain, we've got a long tradition, hundreds of years of people having little plots of land to grow a bit of food. And if anyone wants to do that in Bristol, that was considered normal. If someone was to try and do it in a park, which is designed for leisure, you know, someone would probably get cross with them and say, "Why don't you do that somewhere else, over there, for example?"
Yeah. I mean, the situation is different because in Lisbon there's a lot of land, but there were building. There was a lot of investors. There was a lot of new buildings, and they were little by little, really. They were taking all the land available, so I think that there is a big responsibility for the municipality to stop building things, new things in wasteland, even. I mean, and
but I mean, the pressure is on for them to sell land, isn't it? Mm. Now here in the UK, there's a lot of pressure on them saying, if there's a piece of land and you can sell it, sell it.
Mm. Well, it's a kind of sensitive topic, but I think that the density of the town has reached really a size, or it's really, really, it becomes too dense.
Yeah, and in fact, people start getting angry, don't they? If there's too many in a small space, you need to have a bit of breathing space and a bit of park space.
And we all know that the density of the city has an impact on the well-being for the people, on criminality, also on the way we feel in towns. I know that there is a lot at stake, but I mean, the municipality shouldn't be able to sell the land without noticing the people, without people having their say. And even if it's wasteland or it's considered as wasteland, people should have their say.
Well, we've got a bit a patch of land at the top of White Ladies Road called Easter Garden, mm-hmm. which was created there by local people. And it was just a derelict site, but it was claimed by somebody. And they were trying to claim it for their own by fencing it off. The local people said no, and they just took the fences down, and they've turned that into a garden. Mm-hmm. So that's not the only place in the city where this has happened, but it takes a little bit of being organised, doesn't it? You can't just do it on your own.
Exactly. I mean, if a few people gather and, you know, bring the fences down, but then the municipality put the fences up again. And
I mean, in this case, it was a private person, so they were trying to take the land for their own, and if you have it for 12 years, it becomes yours, yeah? So they said before the 12 years was up, they said, no, we're going to take those fences down. And the guy turned up very annoyed, but he couldn't really do anything. Mm. Anyway, I just wondered if you've seen any really good examples of how well-organised people can be. What's the best example?
The best example maybe is not in the film, actually, but it was an example I saw later. So there is an area which turns into something. At the moment, it's a bit in between housing and factories, and it's quite old. And so a few people, maybe, I don't know, a handful of people, created an association.
Where?
In Geneva. Outside, it's really on the outskirts of Geneva. It's really close to the town. And so that was the first step. Because as an association, they felt more legitimate and they felt stronger. And what they started to think is, okay, there's a few places where the land is not used. The soil is not very good, but they started to design a kind of movable garden. I mean, they can move it because it's only patches, it's only batch. And they can grow things for a year, but then if the owner claim the land, I mean, they can move it in another part of the area. And I think that it's a very good way to design a project. We are not sure that it's going to last, so we plan in advance to move it from an area to another.
So if you find that one of the areas that you're using to grow food is under attack, then you have immediately somewhere else to go.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Anyway, Marie-Lou Storm, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
That was Marie-Lou Storm. She's a Swiss filmmaker, originally born in France, and you can find her film at the following website. It's vimeo.com, V-I-M-E-O, like video, but with an M in the middle, vimeo.com/255359294. That's vimeo.com/255359294.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Okay, so I'm Trevor Melam. I had a business called INEA, the Independent Network of Estate Agents, which was trashed by Lloyds Banking Group for their fraudulent gain. And, it hit me when we got our internal records from Lloyds that they've done fraud to us, criminal fraud. So,
well, there's a lot of people that take loans from banks, Trevor, and they blame the banks when the business folds. But actually, it may be that you were just, you know, you were on a sticky wicket with what you were doing as a business.
No, it's not the case, Tony. I mean, it was very calculated. We was expanding. We had one of the ex-Right Move co-founders, Michael Day, about to come on board as non-exec chair. One of my other partners, Steve Milton, grew Newsstand, the e-commerce site, from 0 to 2 million. We had, as a non-exec director, we had Rob Larson, who rewrote the American MLS real estate structure coding over there. We had an ex-MD who had just taken a turnover up to 64 million.
But it doesn't matter who you got on your board, Trevor, if the numbers don't stack up.
No, it does. Well, the numbers did stack up. The what didn't stack up was what Lloyd's done to us. We had £150,000 next stage funding all ready to go in. And the core reason that the partners didn't put that next funding in was quite simply Lloyd's Bank. What we found out was that Lloyd's had played with our accounts and they concealed bits. And there was collusion between Lloyd's Kent and Lloyd's BSU.
Now, just a minute, because if someone's playing with your accounts, surely that should be you in conjunction with your auditors, not your bankers.
Well, what the bank does, they manipulate you along and they say you've got to swap this product for that product. And what they should do when you're swapping, you expect to swap what you don't expect.
Now, is this one loan for another loan with different conditions?
Well, we were forced into a new loan from the overdraft. Lloyd's originally approached us to take a £200,000 expansion loan to bring out a new product. That was fine. It was all calculated. It was all chartered accountant figures. We put that in. We had meetings with Lloyd's seniors. I took seniors along that were coming on board and already on board. Everything was fine. Lloyd's drove us up to building the prototypes. And as the forensic accountant that we've now got, who is also assisting government bodies on fraud, what he said was Lloyd's knew exactly when you built the prototype that you next needed the sales and marketing money. And that's when they pulled the rug. So what they did, they encouraged us, to build up debt to a point where we then needed to rock and roll and get the sales and marketing. And that's when they pulled the plug.
Well, perhaps your lenders just didn't have confidence in the product, Trevor.
No, I think really it was us who shouldn't have had confidence in them. It's not a case of that. Estate agency was changing. I've been in this game for 33 years. I've been a senior stakeholder consultant on state agency regulation and also on third, fourth money laundering.
I mean, couldn't you just do something simple like change your lender?
We had no reason to. I've been with Lloyd's for, 25 years at the time, and I trusted them. And that's when they introduce criminals into your business, that trust, is something you
rely on. That's a pretty strong allegation. I mean, what evidence do you have for that?
It is a strong allegation, and I can define fraud to you. Most of the victims can't, but it's there's a difference between criminal fraud and civil fraud. Mainly, did the person know what they're doing or not? But fraud is fraud, whether it's criminal or civil. And basically, criminal fraud is party A deceives party B. Party A's gain, party B's loss, or both. For the permanent loss of property, even if it doesn't happen, and that property can be bricks and mortar, it can be intellectual chattels, etc. And we've got evidence of our local Lloyd's in Kent. We got the paperwork that come through, the diesel, and we thought, what the hell have they done? And we could see that.
I know a DSAR is a subject access request, data subject access request.
Yep, we've got that. So with my background of being a stakeholder advisor on a senior level to government, such as Treasury, HMRC, Trading Standards, and Office of Fair Trade when it used to be, I know what fraud is. So when we saw the internal records from Lloyd's, we could see that local staff had, for their advantage, taken disadvantage of us.
Now, I know that the Police and Crime Commissioner...
Just quickly there, Tony, what we could see was that the modus operandi is basically do bait and switch. They take you to a place, and then what they'd done, they had concealed our overdraft account, and they said we had to swap. And we thought that they were going to dead the overdraft, but they didn't. They concealed it, and they run up loads of debt and fees and charges, and that's criminal. Some months they were putting sort of £9,000 charges, which we knew nothing about. We thought we were running on the new loan that we didn't want anyway because it was high
interest rates. So what, weren't you looking at your statements?
No, we couldn't look at statements because we've got the paperwork that shows they cancelled the statements, they cancelled the banking cards, and they cancelled the internet banking. How can you look at what you think is being debited? And that's what Lloyds did. And they kept the account running at Lloyds BSU Bristol. And a certain chap in there kept adding loads of fees. He also got their own surveyors, Collies, to do a below market valuation on my property that we didn't know about, that we find out we've had the honour of paying for. And they, it's what I call perfect Ponzi, Ponzi Plus.
And now, look, Lloyds have got quite a lot of people. I mean, particularly Anthony Stansfield, the Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley, is collating people in that police area, other people around the country. You're now up to about 85 people who believe they've been defrauded by Lloyds. Now, is this all going through the Castlebark branch here in Bristol?
No, it's also Wine Street, Bristol, where the BS, you know, that's where my account was, Wine Street BSU.
And so what are these two particular branches in Bristol? I mean, I don't know if you probably can't call it a Lloyds Bank branch, but they're Lloyds Bank offices. So there's one in Wine Street and there's one on Castle Park.
Yeah, they're operational centres, and they were put out there much like the RBS GRG, and they were put out there to be business support units, and they couldn't be further from the truth. They're set up, we now find out, to be runners, receivers, and what they're there to do, you know, you won't find anybody that's really bringing their business.
So even
out
though it's called a business support unit, it's actually there to literally take your business apart.
Yeah, it's there to asset strip it. The other thing is, we made discoveries about another company that Lloyds had bought, which was State Agency Software. And we found out that Lloyds were data farming. They bought into the company for $17.8 million. They bought another smaller software for another $5 million. And then they sold it 2.5 years later to Zoopla for $75 million. We raised concern because an ex-sales director basically told me that what they were doing, they set up a unit at Reading, which where the HBOS frauds were, and they had 11 bots in there, and they were basically stealing consumer data and selling it on to third parties. I raised this with the CEO, Antonio Zorio, and that's when Lloyds got very, very nasty with me.
So we've had the HBOS at Reading, you just mentioned. There's also Royal Bank of Scotland, the GRG. So almost all of the major banks are doing this. Why not Lloyds too?
Well, criminal. You know, you're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to drink drive. You're not allowed to go out and knife people.
No, well, you've got 85 victims, I know. You've got 85 victims.
We've
assets.
Got 85.
Roughly what amount of assets do you think have been at risk here?
Well, the company at risk, we've just equated last few days, is 250 million. And this is going up by the day. We've got other victims we're talking to. And one of those has potentially got a £600 million claim. Lloyds pulled the rug on them, took their facilities away when they just got contracts in place, and they sold the patents to America.
Now, we've got the Lloyds AGM. Noel Edmonds is one of the probably most well-known of these victims. What was his situation?
Noel's situation. Noel keeps his cards fairly close to his heart. He's doing great things in media. He is in touch with various victims. I do talk to Noel and so on. And, you know, if we put something out there on Facebook, we get 10 hits. Noel puts it out there, you know, he gets 10,000 hits. So we're very appreciative of Mr. Edmonds and all the promotion of Lloyd's wrongs that he's promoted.
So, I mean, you know, what sort of hit has he taken? I mean, he has explained a bit about what's happened to him.
You know, you've seen various bits. Originally, it came out at 300 million, and then it's been 64 million. I don't know. That's something you'd have to ask Noel. But, I mean, I think Noel's would be based on, you know, the artists and that he would have signed up, or he had signed up, and where they would have gone and where that would be. I don't know. That's something you'd have to ask Noel.
So what's the pattern here? You talked about bait and switch, didn't you?
Yeah, so bait and switch. What's concerning is when you talk to some of the police officers, they don't know what bait and switch is, which is quite amusing. But when I was going up to the Home Office and Business Innovation Skills and HMRC, trading standards would often be there. I would get involved because bait and switch was something that state agents mustn't do. And it's a common trading standards term for baiting somebody in, mis-selling to them, and not delivering the goods.
So the switch is from one deal to another deal. So you initially start off on a formally actually on a contract, even if it's just a verbal contract on one deal, and you're baited into changing that, which actually puts you in a financially much worse position.
You're baited. That's what happens. They bait you. Typically with Lloyd's, they've approached people that have wanted to expand their business or quite healthy people, and they baited and said, oh, we can help. We like what you're doing. Why don't you do this? And then what they're doing, they are offering excessive funding to where you need to succeed. And then you're getting two-thirds to halfway through with the funding they deliver. And then they pull the rug. And so it's a bit like going across the desert needing 10 days of water. And someone says, I'll sponsor you. Here's two boxes. And you get halfway across the desert and you open the second box, there's nothing in it.
Well, look, so, maybe the answer, Trevor, is that people shouldn't be taking the bait in the first place.
That's right. You shouldn't be taking the bait because they shouldn't be conning you to do it in the first place. If they were honest, but they're not an honest bank, they're a very dishonest bank. And, you know, we know this from the victim's records. My records are very, very clear. And I've got one of the very top banking professors, Professor Nigel Harper. And he basically says it's fraud, fraud and fraud. I've then got one of the most experienced forensic accountants. And again, he says it's fraud. They've helped us look at everything. And these are both very experienced men.
Now, the former detective at the Metropolitan Police worked on the fraud squad. His name's Rowan Bosworth Davis. He says that the City of London is actually analogous to, in all of the definitions, of organised crime. I mean, it sounds to me as if, you know, obviously you've been a victim of Lloyd's, but there are all sorts of people up to this all over the city and in many banks.
Quite possibly. I mean, the city is its own thing. I think the reason there's a lot of bank fraud in London is because the banks do not lend. What they do a process called securitisation. They just broker debt and they get you to sign a promissory note, which is the loan note, and they sell that on. So the bank typically don't own the debt, they sell it on to an SPV. Now, there's a further stage of that, and in my evidence, we found a much, much bigger loan in 2013 that we never had, $250,000, and that's a process called rehypothecation. And that in America is capped to 140%. In the UK, there's no cap. 60% of lending is in shadow banking. It's the investment banking that we don't see. And if you look at Lloyd's, one thing I found the other week, as Lloyd's tried to con me further and put another statement in that we're ripping to pieces, we found a thing called SEC, and that's the Securities Exchange Commission. That's in Washington, D.C., and that's where Lloyd's files its form 20F reports every year. And if you read that, they're fantastic. They're 350-60 pages, and that shows that the vicarious liability and the fiduciary duties bring now the chairman and the board at Lloyd's right to the front door of the fraud, because they have to sign off the plan for how Lloyd's runs. And the very interesting thing is, if you go in those documents and you do a search on the word business support unit, or on BSU, you'll find that Lloyd state that the BSU units, where there's Bristol, they are the epicentre of Lloyd's securities trades in the UK and the USA. So they're obviously doing the trade over here that they can't do there. What you've got to remember with banking, they may do parts of banking here and parts in Asia. And they would go to where they look at risk averse. And if doing the same process carries less quantity, less consequences in one country, they will do it there and run riskier. The riskier they run, the more toxic debt basically they can put out there. And And what lawyers typically do, their goal is they will go for asset-rich people. And then what they will do is the bug, and then they go for the assets, trying to leave people with nothing to come back and fight them.
Avon and Somerset have had a look at what's going on at Wine Street, Castle Park Branch, the BSU, Business Support Unit, the receivers, Lloyd's receivers, whatever you want to call them, and they said there's nothing to see there at all, actually. In fact, they've had a look and said there's no fraud going on, Trevor.
Fraud is a great thing. When you get fraud covering up fraud, people like Sue Mount-Stevens, she doesn't know her responsibilities under the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act. She's there to hold the police chief to account. And that's not happening. And it's no surprise when her CEO is one of the ex-solicitor partners at one of the firms that have been doing the asset stripping for what was Acorn Finance and Lloyds. So what you've got to remember, Tony, is this is how it works. Rather than buy off loads of police forces and loads of corrupt police, why don't we just default a lot of high net worth customers? And what we do, let's set up some centres in Bristol. We then put them there. When they've got a suspicion that this fraud happened, they put it to actionless fraud. When it's been there for 3 months, it will then go to Avon Somerset. It won't go to Kent Police. It won't go to Liverpool Police, because your account is now in Bristol. You've only then got to buy off the police officers in the local one. There's some very interesting interviews that have happened at Avon Somerset Police. And some of these names, they're identical to some of the Lloyds Bank managers. So, you know, the trouble is, the reason Sue Mount-Stevens has kept saying, oh, it's all civil, is to rub it under the carpet. So what happens, victims then get pushed through the civil courts and the banks will throw wads of money at it. Lloyds bill each year on litigation is $1.2 billion. And they will do that. So even if it's a small debt, if you start bringing out the truth, they will throw wads of money at it to try and kill people off.
So is there any action being taken, do you think, to get a prosecution, maybe by another force rather than even on Somerset?
No, I mean, the victims wouldn't want anybody else in there other than Anthony Stansfield. We all trust him. He's untouchable. And we're very pleased that we've got him in there. There was a few of us. I looked into a lot of the law angles. That's what I used to do with INEA, and find the loopholes. And we found the loopholes. And the trouble was, Mrs. Mount-Stevens said, we don't have the budget. We don't have the resources.
I mean, you made an allegation there about her having some sort of personal interest. Have you got any evidence for that?
Well, you know, she's either a little bit of a silly lady, she doesn't know her duties, or you work it out. You know, why would you keep pushing firm allegations? I mean, the great thing is, we had what we found. We found that we got accommodated by a really good police crime panel led by Mark Weston, and he's now the chair of the crime panel. There was Andrew Sharman, and, you know, there were a few police crime panel members. They welcomed us. They listened to us. Mark, actually, at a second meeting, he took my evidence. My evidence is concrete. You know, I advise government on criminal fraud and bits like that in the property market as a stakeholder. So the thing is, Mark had in his hands concrete evidence of fraud. And at that point, we then said to Sue Mount-Stevens, and she said, oh, we haven't got the budget on that. So we said, you set the budget, Mrs. Mount-Stevens. You set the crime plan. What's your excuse? Anthony Stansfield has offered to help you. So we pushed her into the corner where we said, us victims, we've had enough. We either want her to resign, or we want Anthony Stansfield in there. And that's what's happened. And we now believe they're not only find a load of corruptness at Lloyds Banking Group, but they're also finding it in Avon Somerset Police with some of the officers and some of the police crime panel. But so, not the police crime panel, some of the police crime commissioner office.
Okay, Trevor Mealham, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Alex Joseph. I'm one of the founders of BAFO, Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting.
Forced organ harvesting going on in China. The Chinese say, well, actually, what we're doing is what you Brits do, and that is taking organs out that people consent, and then they're used for transplants.
Well, let's kind of explain it this way. Prisoners of conscience, which includes predominantly Falun Gong practitioners, Tibetans, Uyghurs, they are still persecuted today, as well as Christians. That includes arresting, heavy torture, burning of churches, and the end point of many of these is they're taking their organs and selling them on the black market. So we're not talking about a few isolated cases.
So it's not an official market, it's a black market?
Well, it's run by the Chinese. The lines are very blurred in the Chinese hospitals. If you've got the money, you've got the connections, you can get what you want.
Yeah, forced organ harvesting is, I mean, what evidence have you got that is going on over in China?
Well, investigations have been going on since 2003. David Kilgore and David Mattis, they did an independent investigation. And there's been a recent update with a gentleman called Ethan Goodman. They recently did an update, I think it was 2015, if I remember correctly. So
now, Bristol's twinned with Guangzhou, which is just north of Hong Kong. A lot more people live in Guangzhou. That's about, 20 times at least the number of people who live in Bristol, which is around about 750,000. There's 13 million people there. And am I right in thinking that you believe that this organ harvesting is going on in Guangzhou?
Not just there. That is one of the major cities which is involved.
But it's a bit strange that if what you're saying is true, that Bristol's twinned with this city.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So why are we still twinned with them?
That is a good question. And that is a question I have raised to the mayor and the council. And we have a situation where the UK government is one of few governments which haven't taken a stand against China. Many countries have, including Canada, USA, Czech Republic, the EU even, Taiwan. Many countries have taken a stand against China, but the UK have been hiding behind the Foreign Commonwealth Office.
Well, you have your chance now to present us with what evidence you have that this organ harvesting, forced organ harvesting, is going on. So over to you.
Okay. First of all, it's no longer just a question of just evidence. Papers have been handed to the Commonwealth Office. Papers have been handed to the people in the right roles to investigate this. They haven't read the papers. The correct term to use was David Kilgore mentioned that the China Tribunal is willful ignorance. This is not a case of we need the evidence. This is more of a case of they need to read the evidence which has been handed to them.
So what evidence have you got?
Me personally, there has been investigations that have taken place.
Talking about quantities, you know, for example, you know, specific places where this harvesting is going on, specific individuals who've had their organs harvested, you know, particular organs which are being harvested, you know, that sort of specific evidence.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to squeeze into a small show, but what I have with me, this is a detailed document of the military hospitals which have been involved in this organ harvesting. It's quite an extensive document. It talks about what doctors work in each facility, what they specialize in. I have further documents which explain what organs are going for what amount. You could actually go to the...
Well, the reason I'm asking for details is because the Chinese deny this.
Of course they will. Of course they will.
So what can you say for our listeners to say, well, actually, no, we've got these specific incidents that we've got evidence of?
Well, it's quite easy to investigate this. You can go online and there is an astronomical amount of evidence which suggests this is going place. This is taking place, and it has been for a very long time. The China Tribunal is currently taking place. The second hearing was conducted last month. The first hearing was conducted in December. And even after the last hearing, the council released a statement. And within that statement, they were overwhelmed with the amount of evidence.
Well, I mean, you're talking in general terms. Uh-huh. I want to hear some specific places, people, organs that have been harvested.
You're after a smoking gun. And the situation with organ harvesting in China is that the people who are detained and do have their organs extracted, they are burnt afterwards. There is no remnants
or cremated.
Of their body. Well, cremated, yeah. There is no evidence of their body.
So what about the Bristol Arena and the link to YTL? Because I know that they are planning to build this second version of the Bristol Arena up at Filton somewhere, or Patchway somewhere. Up that, even though it's not going to really even hardly be in Bristol, only just about in Bristol, on the edge of South Gloucestershire. But I understand YTL, who are a Malaysian company, actually do a lot of work in China.
Yes, they do, and this kind of brings it into more of a local arena where YTL's involvement in Bristol is huge. As you know, they own Wessex Water, which was a huge tie for them. They have paid for the mayor's visits to China. They do a lot of work in China. They do a lot of work in Guangzhou. They have a lot of interest in building this arena. And the biggest concern is at what cost? Or what cost? Because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that when you do business with China, it's not just a simple case of they offer you something. You know, there's countless examples. Sri Lanka, Zambia, Djibouti, they did business with China and they lost their ports. They lost huge utilities. Now, if you kind of look at the choices we were given in terms of the location of the arena, one of them meant that the council would still have a vested interest, and the Filton option kind of looks like they won't have.
The thing is that this geopolitics is involved here. If a country like Sri Lanka, which is actually a lot nearer to China than it is to us or the US, is thinking about who do I want to invest here, it's surely it's got a choice as to whether to get US, European investors or Chinese. I mean, you know, that's for them to decide.
Oh, most definitely. And of course, in these modern times, we do have a situation where soft power and hard power is played very strongly. And without a doubt, China and the US, they're very apt at playing these sort of ways of doing things. The difference is with China is that their soft power entails more suppression of their own people. So while China's investing in the rest of the world and using their soft power techniques, investing in universities and businesses and cities, they are still burning churches. They are still arresting people for their religious beliefs. 1 million Uyghurs being detained in Xinjiang is no small number. And, you know, if I had a moment to kind of explain to some of the situations which are taking place there, I won't go into too much detail because it's quite graphic. But just to cut it short, the idea is that people are being detained to help them to re-educate them, to have a better understanding of Chinese culture, Chinese way of life, etc.
I mean, didn't the British, we used to do this sort of thing with teenagers, didn't we? We used to send them to Borstal. We're going to re-educate them. You know, we're going to give them some strict discipline for a while and then send them back into society. And some people, particularly older people today, think that was a good thing. So re-education doesn't have to be bad.
Let me finish. So re-education in Chinese terms actually entails brainwashing. Along with the brainwashing, they are being medically tested, so that's obviously blood testing, DNA, to check whether they're smokers or not. These types of testing is catalogue testing to see which organs are good. You know, testing someone's vision, you can tell whether they're testing someone's vision, whether it's a case of are they okay or are they good for us to sell. There's a very big difference. So, you know, these sort of cases, you can go onto the China Tribunal website and you can listen to the testimonies of some of the Uyghurs, and they are horrendous what some of these women have to put up with. So this sort of thing taking place is not just a case of trying to help the Uyghur people. Xinjiang is a very important location for the future developments of China.
Well, the Chinese will say that many of these people are Muslims. Mm-hmm. We are very concerned that they might turn into the same sort of radical Islam, turn to the same sort of radical Islam as that we've seen in Al-Qaeda, in ISIS and this sort of thing. And therefore, you know, surely it's actually quite prudent to re-educate them in a way. You could use that term if you want to say, well, actually, this type of Islam is poisonous. Please avoid it at all costs.
Yeah, it's a very good way of ensuring that they can do whatever they want.
What about this Belt and Road Initiative? This is seen by many people as a sort of Chinese Marshall Plan. You know, the idea being to pay for redevelopment of entire parts of the developing world. Because let's face it, I mean, the IMF and the West has singularly failed in, for example, in Africa, mm-hmm. to bring those countries to a good state of development. You know, to bring electricity, healthcare, education. And other utilities, even things like clean water. We failed, and the Chinese are saying, well, actually, we're going to give it a go.
Yeah, and this is where the soft power becomes very interesting now. Well, when it comes to wanting more economic gain, more and more nations are running to China. That has been the case for some time now. But when it comes to political stability, they would go to the US. And that poses a problem. Because as you can see, that with this new plan to build a infrastructure stretching from Xinjiang, which is the launch pad, may I might add, is going to stretch from Xinjiang all the way across Asia, all the way across to Europe. It is a huge plan. It's almost unrealistic.
Well, we're talking about a railway running from China all the way, for example, under the Channel Tunnel to the UK. Now,
yeah.
I mean, this is happening effectively anyway with Chinese ships and Chinese imports
yep.
coming by sea.
Yep.
Seems a little bit, you know, quicker and more sensible to send it by rail, doesn't it?
Arguably, it depends what you're sending, of course. But the point being is that they're not just a case of just building a railway and thank you very much, we're going to disappear. They're on about actually owning huge infrastructures across Europe and Asia. So obviously, if you've got an economic foothold that China are looking to build, you are going to actually have a political.
But I mean, there's a risk for China in that, isn't there? Because you could easily get some country say, well, actually, all that infrastructure you've just mm-hmm. built, China, we're going to nationalise it. It's ours now. And they could lose everything. So
yeah.
It's a risky thing for them to do, surely.
Yeah, if they could keep up with the payments, that is one issue, is that, you know, some of the loan offerings that China are offering, it does lead to them being in a sticky situation. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, Zambia, Sri Lanka, they are prime examples who have lost their ports because they couldn't keep up with payments.
Certainly.
Kenya are in hot water as well. It's not just a case of China offer you something for nothing.
So anyway, look, back to these China tribunals and the organ uh-huh. harvesting. How are you getting on with persuading Bristol City Council they should think twice about twinning with Guangzhou?
That is a very good question. We do have a petition running, and the petition is not all and end all. The petition is there to give the council the opportunity to bring this into discussion. We have contacted councillors, we have contacted MPs. Let's say the situation is that the mayor cannot see the implications or the dangers, really, of this relationship with Guangzhou. And the term willful ignorance really does really stand true.
I mean, if you could say one thing to convince the mayor to listen, what would that be?
Investigate.
Open
your eyes.
That's your job. You investigate. And yeah. then what would you, you know, what evidence have you got for the mayor?
I would say to him, read these reports. You know, they're 400-page reports, which are really worth reading. I would actually say to him, come to the next China Tribunal or listen to the hearings of the China Tribunal. Effectively, do your own research because the Foreign Commonwealth Office are not really helping.
So whereabouts do we find the China Tribunal online, Alex?
So if you go on your, just do a Google search, China Tribunal, it'll be the first link there.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, the Bristol Crime of the Century man, that's Trevor Mealham from the Lloyds Bank Support Group. Also, Growing Food in Cities with Marie-Luce Storm's film The Gardens of Hope, and from Bristol Against Organ Harvesting, Alex Joseph. Also thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. If you're on the internet, that's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8pm. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Step off the train, I'm walking down your street again, and past your door, but you don't live there anymore. It's years since you've been there, and now you disappeared somewhere. I got a space, you found some better place, and I miss you. Found some better place, and I miss you.